I think I commented on it a couple of weeks ago, but this photograph, which is being projected here, is one of my favorites. I like it because they're obviously in a hurry. They're in a hurry racing to see this light that's coming to the world. And I have a certain empathy for them because I've traveled to the Middle East many times. I've been to Israel and the West Bank 18 or 19 times now. And typically there's some point at which a camel appears and people get to ride a camel. And the tourist gets on and they charge you $1 or $2. You get on the camel, stands up, you walk around in a circle, and you get off. And the camel guardian, shepherd, guide, they always miss a bet. They should let you get on for free and charge you $10 to get off because they're nasty, smelly, bouncy things. But I had the chance a few years ago. I took a group to the Holy Land and then led a group on down into Egypt. And we went to the Sinai and went to the base of Mount Sinai, the traditional site on which Jesus, on which Moses received the epiphany of God appearing to him and received the Ten Commandments. And so I got up at 1 a.m. and we went to the camel renting place and rented a camel and guides and began a two-hour ride by camel up Mount Sinai. One of the most uncomfortable things I've ever done. Although I'm told that it's even more uncomfortable if you ride it down. But and it was pitch black, pitch black. No, we started out at 5,500 feet in the desert where there's absolutely no fog or cloud. There was no artificial light for 50 miles, middle of nowhere. We started at 5,500 feet at 2 a.m. and rode for 2 hours up, and brilliant stars overhead. Brilliant stars, except for that whole quadrant of the sky over there that was just absolutely black. Finally realized that was the mountain blocking out the stars. 2 hours we rode, finally dismounted and climbed the last 1,000 feet on foot to discover hundreds of people up there all waiting for the sun to rise over the mountains of Sinai. One of the most wonderful things I've ever experienced. So I have a certain empathy for these wise men who rode their camels through the darkness toward the light. There are Bible scholars who put together each year a lectionary, and it's a three-year cycle. If you go through it, and many of you come from churches that are more liturgical than this one, if you go through a three-year cycle, you've worked your way through most of the Bible. Each lectionary day has a reading from the Torah, the books of history in the Old Testament, one from the prophets, one from the Gospels, and one from the letters in the New Testament. And these four together are linked some way, and sometimes you have to really study and think to see how they're linked. But as I wanted for this day, which is the Sunday 2 weeks after Christmas, when we see the light that has come into the world at Christmas, I wanted to look at those, and I wanted to begin with a passage from Isaiah chapter 60. Now, Isaiah is actually three different books of the Bible, but we know it as simply one. The first 39 chapters of the book of Isaiah were written by Isaiah, who lived in the 8th century before Christ. He lived in the northern kingdom of Israel and was a prophet called by God to do what prophets are always called to do, to afflict the comfortable or to comfort the afflicted. When everything is going along peachy keeno and everything is great and the real estate bubble is expanding and the stock market's up and everything is wonderful, then the prophet says, yes, but you're forgetting the poor, the needy. You're too full of yourselves. You're too proud. It's going to bust. The job of the prophet also is to say to people who have lost everything, who have nothing, who have no hope, the afflicted. Yes, but there is hope. There is a future. God still loves you, and the future will be better. So a prophet's role is to look at the mirror images, to afflict the comfortable, and to comfort the afflicted, and always to make people... A prophet is not there to predict the future. A prophet's really there to change the future by calling on you and me to act differently than we are at the present time, whether we're up or down, to look at life differently and change that future which is prophesied. And so Isaiah, first 39 chapters, Isaiah written 8 centuries before Christ, at a time when the nation of Israel was fat, dumb, and happy, full of itself, and then started seeing some empires, the Assyrians and others, rising against it, and they were bigger than Israel, and they started making alliances with the Egyptian Empire, and they started building up their army, and the prophet said, don't trust in alliance with Egypt. Don't trust in your horses and chariots. Don't trust in the bow and the sword. Trust in God. That's the only thing that's going to save you. And they did not. And they were wiped from the face of the earth in the Assyrian campaigns. And in about the year 722 BC, they disappear. Those 10 tribes that form the northern nation of Israel disappear from history. You ever heard of the lost tribes of Israel? Yeah. You know what happened to them?
No.
Gone. Destroyed. And so Isaiah warns them. 2 centuries pass. The southern kingdom of Judah, from which we get the word Jew, had struggled along with its capital in Jerusalem after the disaster that happened to northern Israel. And a new empire comes against them, the Babylonians. And once again they're warned, and once again they fail to follow God, to trust God, to love God. And they too are destroyed by the Babylonians and go into what is known as the Babylonian captivity, the exile. Their nation is destroyed, their temple is destroyed, their homes and their cities are destroyed, and the intelligentsia and the nobility, the leading people, are all driven off into exile in far-off Babylon, Iraq, 500 miles across desert from home. And there, as the 137th Psalm writes, there we knelt by the waters and wept. They lost everything. Although, because they lost everything, they did not want their memory of their relationship to God to disappear with them, with their homes and their cities. So it's during the time of the Babylonian captivity, the exile, that they begin, scholars believe, to start writing down their stories. Before, they've been passing them along at home, but now they begin to write them down, and so we see the beginnings of what today we have as the Old Testament. The core of our Bible was written down because people had lost their homes, lost their institutions, lost everything, and so they wanted to write this down to make sure that future generations would not forget the relationship that they'd had with God, how they had trusted God, how they let God down, how they had suffered because of it, how God came back to try to redeem them, and how they followed God, and then how they would fail again, and on for centuries. That's in the book of Isaiah. Now, from the 40th chapter, how many of you have heard Handel's Messiah? Of course you have. Comfort ye, comfort ye, my people. That's Isaiah chapter 40. That's a second Isaiah whose theme is similar. Whereas first Isaiah had afflicted the comfortable, second Isaiah comforts the afflicted. And 2 centuries after first Isaiah, and it all gets lumped together in one book, he's saying, your warfare is ended. There will be a straight path made for you. Every valley shall be lifted up, every hill made low, and you shall journey back home. That's second Isaiah. And then around chapter 55 is a third Isaiah who picks up that theme and interprets the suffering and struggles of the people of Israel as they're being a suffering servant of God. It's not that their suffering is meaningless, it's that it has meaning. And in their suffering, there will be a new kind of relationship with God formed, the suffering servant imagery, which Christians later pick up and say that in Jesus they saw a suffering servant as well. And so that brings us to chapter 60 of Isaiah. A message of hope to people who have no hope. Arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord has risen upon you. For darkness shall cover the earth, and thick darkness the peoples. But the Lord will arise upon you, and his glory will appear over you. Nations shall come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your dawn. And then skipping down, a multitude of camels shall come to you. All those from Sheba shall come. They shall bring gold and frankincense and shall proclaim the praise of the Lord. Did you hear that? Kings shall come on camels bringing gold and frankincense. Ah, I remember that from the Gospel of Matthew, because there are only two places in the Bible that talk about the birth of Jesus, Matthew and Luke. And in the birth narrative in Matthew and Matthew alone, he talks about the wise men or the kings who come, doesn't mention camels, but shall come bringing gold and frankincense and myrrh. Myrrh is simply a kind of frankincense. What Matthew is doing is, because he knows Isaiah so well, he's trying to say to the people at the beginning of the gospel, you've lived in darkness, but there's light. You've lived in despair, but there's hope. And so he uses the imagery of Isaiah 60 to reinforce that the coming of Jesus is the coming of light and hope to a people in despair and darkness. We began, 14, 15 years ago, a new millennium. This is 2015, right? So let's see, it's been 14 years since 2000, but the millennium didn't actually begin to 2001, so I'm a little confused, but, you know, a decade and a half ago or so, we started a new millennium and a new century. And, you know, we kind of stumbled and fell. You know, I'm old enough to remember General Electric, I think, I said it so well, better things for better living through electricity. In the 50s, the future was going to be great. We were going to go to the moon. We were going to have space stations. We were going to use atomic power for our cars. We were going to have better things for better living through electricity. The world was going to get better and better and better. We were building new schools. We were building new churches. The country was growing. We were on top of the world. The future looked good. And then, I don't know, 1999, Y2K, all our computers will explode. September 11th, 2001, a series of wars, terrorism, reality TV, passwords, and things just seemed to get out of control, and we somehow lost our hope. We're having a family reunion this weekend, God help me. And several of the family are in computers and technology, and they were discussing yesterday about passwords. And about, you know, we've got to get past the point of having to remember this different, you know, 12 letter thing. At least some have to be caps and at least one exclamation point in it for this and then a different one for that. And it's like, oh my God. So you carry this little piece of paper around in your pocket with all your passwords to protect the stuff that will get lost if anybody steals your pants. And then I was trying to get them to fix some things on my computer, which were all the fault of Windows 8. But they said, don't worry, soon they're coming out with Windows 10, which will solve all the problems of Windows 8, which solved all the problems of Windows 7, which... But then there'll be Windows 12 to fix what comes next. So where's the hope? Where's the light at the end of the tunnel? It's not been a good millennium so far. And because we now have 24/7 news on hundreds of channels and an infinite variety of sources of news on the internet, we are subjected to an incredible amount of bad news, and we are inundated in darkness. Now, my belief is that for every advance in human technology, in every advance in population, and everything that happens, there's equal but opposite potential for good and evil. But we just get overwhelmed. We get totally overwhelmed. Somebody's talking about buying a new car this last week, and you know, how do you start it? There's no key. You know, and you have to fiddle with this dial to decide, do you want it on sit, drive, race, ticket? You know what? And you just have no idea. How do you start the car? You know, and if the little light comes on, you're doomed. You know, life is so incredibly full of potential, and yet so incredibly complicated, and we just kind of go into mental gridlock. Don't you feel so often that there's this miasma, this fog, this darkness that where's the hope? Where's the light? Where's the possibility in the future and the joy looking forward? And I want us to recover that in this 15th year of this new century and new millennium. No matter what we have to deal with, it's nothing compared to what the people of ancient Israel were going through. They'd lost everything. The best analogy I can make is to think of the fact that 1/4 of the population of Lebanon today are Syrian refugees, that 3/4 of the population of Jordan today are refugees from Palestine, Iraq, and Syria. If you look at the plight of refugees from Iraq and Syria and these countries, how they've lost everything, that's where the people of Israel were when the prophet says, "Arise, shine, for your light has come." Hopeless situations, given up, no possibilities, but God's not through with us yet. God's not through with us yet. We will in a moment be invited to communion. Everybody here is invited to communion. You don't have to be a member of the church. You just have to acknowledge that at some point in your life, you've been in darkness. At some point in your life, there's not been a whole lot of hope or joy or possibility. That things get pretty dim. But that you reach out to God saying, "God, I need a hand. I need some light. I need some hope. I need to know that I'm still loved. I need to know that there is a future." In communion, we are celebrating the fact that God comes into our existence and is willing to go through anything with us. So the worst that we can do, the worst that humanity can do, and it's inhumanity, God's with us. Jesus, this baby honored with gold and frankincense and a star, God, human form, subject to all the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, bringing together a band of friends and then discovering that one of them has betrayed him, that all of them will run away, none of them understand him, and at the end of his road is torture and death. Death at the hands of the greatest religion the world had yet produced, the religion of Israel. "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." And the leaders of that religion failed to understand the next step that God was taking. And so they hand him over to the leaders of the finest civilization that the Western world had created, the Roman Empire, with all its laws and administrative ability, to crucify him. The worst that could possibly happen. And then they took him down from a cross and buried him. End of story. It's all over. It doesn't get darker than that. Nothing that faces us in this new year can be as dim as the prospects that face Jesus. Arise, shine, your light has come. if you don't understand the sermon, if you don't remember any of it, then at least take home your bulletin and read again the statement of faith that we have shared from the United Church of Canada, which was an amalgamation of the Methodist Church, Presbyterian Church, and the Congregational Church in Canada. It says this: we're not alone. We live in God's world. We believe in God, who has created and is still creating, who's come in Jesus to reconcile and make new, who works in us and others by the Spirit. We trust in God. We are called to be the church, to celebrate God's presence, to love and to serve others, to seek justice and to resist evil, to proclaim that Jesus crucified and risen is our judge and our hope. In life, in death, in life beyond death, God is with us. We're not alone. Thanks be to God. Pray with me. Oh God, it is so very, very easy to lose hope, to throw up our hands, to say that the world is going to hell in a handbasket. But we live in your world. You have created and you are still creating. And in Jesus you reconcile and make new. It may not be possible for us to accomplish anything, but it is for you. We are called to work with you, to do your will, to do what we can to seek justice in human society and to resist evil. But if our efforts fail, yours will not. We're not alone. Thanks be to you, O God. Amen.